Blog Talk Radio.
Hour for April 22nd, that's Earth Day, and this is your host, Poke Runyon, and as you have read our abstract, know that tonight we're going to deliver a paper called Dark Mirror Evocation and Angelic Invocation, and then we'll have I'll have a short discussion on that paper afterward. Now, this lecture was originally delivered at a symposium hosted by the Fraternity of the Hidden Light on October 5th, 2002. And I'll begin, and then after we are finished with the paper, we'll have some more time, and I want to present a less scientific and less psychological perspective, because quite frankly, this paper emphasizes the psychological and the scientific aspects of both evocation and invocation, and I think that it may be a little too unromantic for some people, certainly for me especially. I read it over again. I think we need to get the romance back into this. And so after we get done with the paper, we'll try to re-romanticize the subject. So I'll go right into it. Well, before we get to the meat of this discussion, please allow me to clarify a few points regarding the OTA's angelic invocation and spirit evocation techniques. Now, these practices have nothing whatsoever to do with black magic or Satanism. The way our system is constructed, it could not even be misused for dark and sinister purposes without a sinister effect on the person himself. In other words, a serious psychic backlash to anyone unwise enough to make such an attempt. Now, why is this so? Well, for the compelling reason that in our system, one's own reflection in a mirror is used as a start point for conjuration to visible appearance in spirit evocation. Now, this is a practice which the uninformed refer to as summoning demons. Now, you don't have to be a rocket scientist to realize that trying to send a psychic component of your own personality, no matter how archetypal and transpersonal that component might be, off to hurt somebody else. This is analogous to lighting the fuse on a stick of dynamite, then wishing it would somehow fly out the window, sail all the way across town, and blow up your enemy. In this case, your enemy is yourself, and you are a lot closer to home. Now, I'm not saying that these angels, spirits, and elementals are entirely individual and personal. On the contrary, we all share in a universal population of archetypes, shadow fragments, and even superior and inferior non-human sentient beings. But our perceptions of these entities are always subjective. We access a greater universe beyond through the lesser universe within. As my esteemed colleague, Maestro Lon Duquette, puts it, it's all in your head, but you have no idea how big your head is. And as I said in the Magic of Solomon video, your mind reaches out to the farthest star, as above, so below. I would remind those poorly informed critics who jump to the conclusion that the OTA is ceremonial magic, because of its dimly lighted setting, its exotic trappings, and its sombrous conjurations, is therefore evil and sinister. It is no more evil and sinister than Tibetan Tantric Buddhism, and certainly no more demonic than that venerable tradition. As in Tibetan Tantric practice, we master the rebellious spirits within ourselves on the path to spiritual enlightenment. The Tibetans have hundreds of gods, goddesses, and demons, and yet they are still Buddhists. We, in the pantheon of pre-biblical gods, goddesses, and demons, and all of the angels, and yet we are still hermetic. And all of these manifestations are aspects of one ineffable, omnipresent, and omniscient great architect of the universe, whose identical sparks of holy fire ensoul us all. As I have said, we have a spiritually valid, well-balanced system of ceremonial magic perfected in over 30 years of constant practice. But we are not the only people who engage in such activities. In the last 10 years, there's been a worldwide revival of Solomonic ceremonial magic. Now, the OTA was indirectly responsible for this popularization. Over the years, our secret techniques began to leak out, and finally, when a distorted version of our poetic invocation method was mass marketed by a major occult publisher, we decided that we would come forward and we would openly teach what we had originally discovered and developed in secret. Unfortunately, the unauthorized popular version of our method ignored the prerequisites of self-hypnosis training, yoga training, and the angelic spiritual balancing so necessary for positive, progressive, and meaningful practice in this art. One of the major spiritual and psychological problems inherent in the magical evocation of King Solomon's rebellious spirits in this modern godless age is the lack of a balancing, positive, or higher power to satisfy the evocation of lower or disorganized elements of the psyche that we call spirits. Now, this lack of balance affects almost any magician willing to venture into such deep waters because he or she is a rebel to begin with and often has turned his or her back upon the deeply imprinted symbols of traditional religion. I think this is a mistake. Now, I'm a hermetic classical pagan, but I long ago discovered the awesome power of the traditional Judeo-Christian and Muslim archangels, especially the four quadrant guardians, Raphael, Michael, Gabriel, and Uriel. In OTA practice, we do not permit any member to participate in goetic evocation operations before he or she has undergone a series of four separate angelic invocations. These four great archangels not only govern the four compass quadrants of the magic circle, they also rule the four elemental signs of the zodiac, the signs of air, fire, water, and earth. Through these triplicities, they also govern the 72 lesser angels of the Shemeham Farash, who also inhabit the great circle of the zodiac on a level just above the 72 fallen angels of the Goetia. Now, I do not wish to give the impression that the Goetia's spirits and the Shemeham Farash angels were created together as components of the same system back in medieval times. Solomon's Goetia spirits may have been originally of Hebrew origin, but they came to us filtered through the Arabians and written down by the Christians. They are the 72 jinn of the Arabian Nights, contained in a sealed brass vessel and assigned to the levels of a Christian Tartarus, not to a Hebrew Cliffarth. At about the same time, this is about 500 years ago, the 72 Shemayam Farash angels, who had been created from a cipher based upon three verses in Exodus recounting Moses' parting of the Red Sea, escaped from the Hebrew Kabbalah and were welcomed into the Hermetic Kabbalah. And it didn't take very long for the Hermetic practitioners to add the sigils and Latin invocations to the Shemayam Farash. And the next step was obvious. They became the governing counterparts for the rebellious spirits of the Galatia. So far, so good. But no one seems to agree on the starting point or the actual order of the angels and the spirits around the zodiac. The Golden Dawn starts their progression at 0 degrees Leo. Von Duquette, following Crowley, splits his Galatia spirits into separate day and night sequences. Aaron Lettich breaks the Shemayam Farash sequence into four elemental triplicities in yet another attempt to connect the Kabbalah with the Enochian system, but the OTA keeps it simple. Our Master Mandala starts at 0 degrees Aries for both Galatia and Shemayam Farash sequences, running them straight around the zodiac together, and it works very well. You should always briefly invoke the appropriate Shemayam Farash angel before summoning any Galatia spirit. The angel's sigil should be on the obverse side of the Galatia spirit parchment sigil in your brass vessel. However, I will go further to recommend that you invoke the Shemayam Farash angel into a crystal using the Almadel method on the evening previous to your first encounter with any Galatia spirit as a separate and complete operation. You will find these angels very helpful and very powerful. Now, you may also do this in the same session before the Goetic invocation. Now, this requires moving some temple furniture around between the invocation and the evocation, but it does work very well. This follows after your four invocations of the archangels in your training period, ruling the compass quadrants and the Shemayam Farash. So, how do we invoke angels? Well, in these operations, we use an altar in the middle of the circle with a crystal orb in its top center. And the altar is constructed in such a way that the four candles at each corner are shielded and reflected inward. The altar top is ventilated so that the incense from below will float up through the slots in the top and surround the orb with luminous tendrils of pungent smoke. We sit on low stools surrounding the altar, and we gaze up at the orb from an angle that automatically induces an altered state of consciousness. Round-robin invocations are intoned while those not invoking call the angel's name in a droning overtone chant, Raphael, 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 Raphael. When contact is achieved, we see a gold and blue-violet aura on the altar top. This glory is exactly as described by the famous 17th century magician Dr. Thomas Rudd in his treatise on angel magic. When we are invoking an angel or archangel, we use a crystal orb, crystal ball, rather than a mirror, because an angel is a messenger of God. To conjure an angel in a mirror that reflects the world is not as appropriate as calling him or her, because we envision male and female angels according to the nature of their assignment, into a crystal that is a catalyst for higher energy. Likewise, it's not necessary to actually see an angel in human form. They are creatures of light. And not only do the old texts, such as Dr. Rudd's treatise on angel magic, confirm this, But Frederick Kahn's excellent book, Crystal Vision for Crystal Gazing, also tends to confirm it. Here again, the experience and the knowings are subjective, but they are very powerful. Our self-hypnosis training enables almost every intelligent, determined, and focused student to be a channeler. We ask each participant in turn, does the angel speak through you? In many cases, everyone around the altar will voice an oracle. Now, we base our modern OTA round the altar Almadel system on the Lemegeton's book, Almadel. Now, we built a replica waxen Almadel for our video, The Magic of Solomon. And this marvelous tabletop device has to be seen in operation to be really appreciated. The smoke rises in tendrils around a crystal set on a slab of translucent glowing wax. Our modern version still uses the rising smoke and surrounding candles, but with the added advantage, of course, this is the altar, of hiding the several participants sitting on low stools from each other's views. And the altar horns shield the light, directing it inward for an even more spectral effect. Well, now that we have the angels firmly on our side, both within us and above us, we can move into the discussion of evocation. Now, evocation means literally to evoke something out of yourself, your subconscious, your lower self. In the case of classic goetic evocation, we are dealing with rebellious spirits or disorganized elements of the psyche. Now, the Jungian concept of mythological archetypes in a collective unconscious gives these personal psychic components a transpersonal universal existence. And now, in this process, we first call upon the higher powers, in psychological terms, this would be the higher self, or God, the angels, or whatever else you want to use to symbolize the ordered force that rules the micro and the macrocosms of the universe. Now, in this case, our magic circle represents this ordered universe. The triangle outside the circle represents the philosophical geometry of containment. In effect, the four points of creation minus the fifth point, which would set the creation in motion. Hence, the confinement of the spirit within the triangle. Now, understanding this should make it clear that the circle is not a circle of fear, but rather a circle of power. The magician has replicated a 9-foot miniature of the universe within which he stands as God. And the triangle is God's manifesting plane. Considering this, it should be obvious that doing classical evocation operations without a circle, or at least casting a circle via a pentagram ritual, is not really evocation at all, but more of an experiment in spiritualism rather than ceremonial magic. Now, Crowley wrote in his foreword to the 1904 Goetia that most students of ceremonial magic are fools. Unfortunately, he was, and in some instances still is, correct. Anyone who seriously believes that he or she can conjure an alien spirit creature to visible, photographable, bite you in the leg, physical appearance, simply by muttering ancient incantations, is, in my opinion, round the bend and up the pole. So what is the point of any practical attempt at magical evocation by sane, intelligent people? No point, unless we adopt a subjective, non-materialistic, and in some instances psychological, view of what a spirit is and is not. Now, surprisingly, once we start to study the works of magicians from the 1500s on through to modern times, that's Cornelius Agrippa, John Dee, Dr. Thomas Rudd, Frederick Hockley, Aleister Crowley, Dion Fortune, and Lon Duquette, we begin to realize that the few actual masters of this fool's art were really always aware of its subjective and, even though they didn't use the term, its hypnotic nature. With the advent of Jungian psychophilosophical conceptions in the 1920s, this subjective reality was given a transpersonal dimension via the theory of archetypes and the collective unconscious, thus finally explaining that enigmatic passage in the Hermetic Asclepius, which reads, "The gods of the zodiac are eternal, but man creates the gods of the earth sphere." However, until the latter half of the 20th century, successful and replicatable methods of goetic evocation remained inaccessible to anyone without clairvoyant ability. Crowley's early attempts to conjure a goetic spirit in smoke was a sad example of such a fruitless effort. More recently, the obsessive and heroically demanding Goetia experiments of Maestro Steve Savdo, while remarkable in their hallucinatory intensity, are valuable proof of what the mind can be induced to visualize, but they've tended to confirm the questionable value of such inelegant approaches to the challenge of conjuration to visible appearance. Crowley got Barrere's foot after several hours of continuous and exhaustive conjuring. Crowley was trying to do it the hard way, in smoke, which is virtually an impossibility without a conjuration device, crystal or mirror, behind the smoke. We in the OTA use incense smoke in front of the dark mirror on the upright triangle. Coming up from the sensor mounted in the circle, or coming up around the crystal on the altar in an Almadel operation. Now, this is the way smoke was actually used in the Renaissance and medieval magic. Crowley was under the influence of Mathers, who had a phobia against hypnosis in any form. Now, this, in my opinion, crippled the Golden Dawn in its magical scrying techniques. But Mathers must have known, from all he read in the Renaissance and medieval magical literature, that the shoestone and speculum were supposed to be employed, as stated over and over in the Lamegaton and in the treatise on ancient magic. In this crystal stone, in this triangle, the basic problem with accepting the dark mirror for the excellent conjuration device that it is, lies not with the art, the technique, its authenticity, or the ease with which it can be mastered. It lies with the student himself or herself. Learned magicians have always known that the visual manifestation of a spirit, however universal and transpersonal it may be, on the deepest level begins within the self. The very meaning of evocation is a bringing up from within yourself. God created man in his own image. And the Ispiclarion, the magic mirror of the Kabbalists, was based upon this principle. In 1969, I took a fresh approach to the problem, and I discovered, or perhaps rediscovered, that the dark mirror facial reflection distortion phenomenon used in the East to evoke previous incarnations, and in West Africa to visualize one's ancestors, and use my children to scare themselves in the Bloody Mary game, worked perfectly as a method of goetic conjuration to visible appearance. It worked for non-clairvoyants, normal, ordinary people. It was fast, it was powerful, and it was very effective. Within 35 years, this OTA method, first popularized by Nelson White and then by Donald Craig, has become standard practice and has generated, we believe, a worldwide Goetia revival. It is the method of choice for most present-day Goetia magicians, and even those who are clairvoyant and don't need the facial reflection distortion phenomenon themselves realize that their students will probably need it. Now, taking the reflection distortion phenomenon at face value, pun intended, we can draw several firm conclusions. It has been with us for a long time, probably longer than the concept of reincarnation. It is startling in its effect, and it does not lose power with repetition, as so many drug-induced trances. Now, third, even in its non-directed use, it is a form of auto-hypnosis. So, we have a marvelous way to contact the other side, the deep mind, the collective unconscious, the astral plane. Remember, the mirror is a reverse world. Your reflection is not really you. It can be equated with the matter-antimatter paradox in modern physics. Mirrors are powerful magical devices. The facial reflection distortion technique works for normal people even better than it does for psychics, because psychics usually receive off-face. But how do we learn to ride this wild horse? How do we get Bloody Mary to talk with us and sign our Liber Spiritum and get the job that we assigned done? Here is where the popularizers of our method drop the ball. Neither of the writers previously mentioned explained the essential OTA self-hypnosis and Pranayama yoga training. This meant that the student, using their edited versions of the original system, had to work from the idea of the operator hypnotizing the receiver without admitting it, and being in total control of the receiver's trance state. Now, to cover this obvious flaw in the approach, one writer advised against solo operations. Well, actually, for a well-trained OTA operator and receiver, solo operations are just as safe or safer than operator-controlled sessions. Self-hypnosis training for operators and receivers should be mandatory, and I think that any teacher of this method who does not insist on every student experiencing and perfecting both operative and scrying abilities should be avoided. Self-hypnosis is essential to the development of the verbal dialogue ability in the trance state. In other words, if you want to have a real conversation with the spirit, then you better do your homework. Pranayama yoga, that's the yoga of the fixed gaze, is necessary to train receivers how to look at dark mirrors and crystal orbs. Most people haven't the faintest idea of how to look at a conjuration device. Pranayama develops the ability to stare at the device without studying it, contemplating it, or, especially important, analyzing the optical phenomenon as they occur in the scrying process. So, now that we have the theory, the method, and the preliminary training, how then do we do it? Well, you'll need a triangle raised on an easel, a dark circular mirror to hang in the center of the triangle, some form of circle with the four quadrants, a thurible on a short tripod to place before the triangle, and charcoal and incense for the thurible, a pair of candlesticks that can be held in the receiver's hands, a lamen of the proper metal, for example, copper for Venus Netzach operations, your wand, ring, and a black grease pencil to put the spirit sigil on the mirror and on the polished lamen around the receiver's neck. Now, for a formal operation, you should have at least a receiver, an incense server, and an operator. You may also employ a scribe to record the spirit's oracles as they are being delivered. Preliminary meditation on the nature of the working is essential. Now, this should include pranayama and the induction of a light trance to get everyone into a similar mood, mindset, and trance level. When this is achieved, the temple should be formally opened with a lesser invoking pentagram ritual performed, followed by a planetary septagram ritual opening the sphere of Yesod. I'll mention that all Goetia workings are in the Kabbalistic lunar sphere of Yesod, even though the spirits themselves are attributed to different spheres or sephirot. Remember, of course, that each sephira contains its own complete 10-sphere tree of life within itself. It's a little complicated, but Kabbalah is, unfortunately, not as simple as we'd like it to be sometimes. After the preliminary meditation, the opening of the temple and the pentagram, the septagram rites, we begin to circumambulate a magic circle deosil to a drum beat And with a bell rung at the passing of the eastern quarter, and this movement is accompanied by a continuous overtone chanting. Once we enter the circle, the operator stands behind the receiver, works the wand up and down the psychic centers of the receiver's back while conjuring. We use only the first conjuration from the Galatia, and we usually don't have to repeat it more than three times. I'll do a little bit of that. I call it my parliaments, his parliaments, his parliaments, his parliaments, and the mighty princes, and the agonies, ministers of the seat of Tartarus, and chief princes of the throne of Apology, and the ninth region, come from whatever part of the world thou art, come presently, come visibly, come affably, and manifest that which we desire, being summoned by the true and living God, you are your. Now, I hope nobody's getting anything right now. I didn't mean to do that. Okay, the operator should sense the contact, but should also ask the receiver, do you have a presence, before he welcomes the spirit. Now, the receiver has been through the blackout phase and has the spirit in the mirror. He or she can say, yes, I have presence, or he's here. And the operator welcomes the spirit. Now, in the case of a pagan god or a goddess, the operator will apologize for the strong conjuration and venerate the deity. An oracle may be asked for and received. And the very unusual thing about the magical trance state created by our self-hypnotic training is that it allows for a three-way conversation to take place during the reception phase of the operation. The operator can question the spirit directly or have the receiver intercede. And the spirit may break in at any time it feels moved to do so. And all in all, the spirit experience is remarkable. But the training, which the popularizers of our method omitted, is vitally important. The operator should not keep the spirit too long. This puts a strain on the dream state. We summon them, and then we send them away. We never let them fade out. Now, after the license to depart, snuff the candles, turn the lament, cover the mirror, and perform a closing planetary septagram, lunar, followed by a lesser banishing ritual, the pentagram, close the temple in due form. Immediately, you should sit down in the hermitage and carefully log the experience and the information you received. Now, otherwise, like a dream, it will fade away very quickly. At this point, there may be some confusion regarding our obvious veneration of two of our Goetia spirits. Now, we are in the order of the Temple of Astarte. The ancient Canaanite goddess of love, who was transformed by Judeo-Christians into the so-called demon Astaroth, and her ancient consort, Prince Baal, the Canaanite thunder god, who was likewise demonized as Baal and became the first spirit of the Goetia. Now, in the manner of Tibetan Tantric Buddhists, who venerate ancient goddesses Tara and Vajrayogini and her consort, we have retained our hermetic philosophy while we develop a magical religion to serve a higher purpose. The 72 rebellious spirits of King Solomon's legendary brass vessel were, according to Arabian lore, the genie who aided biblical King Solomon in building the Great Temple. Now, the philosophical and psychological analogy behind this was quite obvious. The brass vessel is the human mind, and the temple is the great work that the rebellious spirits, components of the universal and individual mind, are compelled to accomplish. According to the biblical allegory, wise King Solomon united all the peoples of the Holy Land in one great effort to erect the temple to the supreme and ineffable God, who was worshipped under several names by Jews, Israelites, Canaanites, Phoenicians, and Amorites alike. Now, this was a perfect example of the Hermetic philosophy of one ultimate God who permeates and animates all things. When Solomon called upon Hiram of Tyre, a Phoenician priest king, to help him build the great temple, King Hiram of Tyre said, "Praise the Lord!" Now, this Lord that King Hiram, the Phoenician, was praising, was known as El, a Leflamed. That same El, who was the Most High God of Hiram's ancient ancestor, the Canaanite priest king Melchizedek. It was Melchizedek the righteous who gave the patriarch Abraham his original dispensation through the first Eucharist of bread and wine. Judaism, Christianity, and Islam all claim descent from Abraham. Jesus of Nazareth was twice declared by Paul to have been a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Thus, Melchizedek's Most High God, El, the Compassionate, is the original Heavenly Father of all three of the world's great monotheistic religions, and the reconciler of all differences between them. For those who are enlightened enough to perceive the sublime truth in the biblical allegory of wise King Solomon and his friend and ally, King Hiram of Tyre, who both worked together to build a temple to a god they worshipped by different names and in different ways. But with one god, we are still left with the problem of patriarchal imbalance. El is masculine, and yet, in the most ancient holy books, the pre-biblical tablets of Ugarit from Rosh Hashanah, we find that El ruled jointly with his consort, Lady Asherat of the Sea, who may be considered his feminine aspect, while the son of Jehovah, according to the Christians, was Jesus of Nazareth. Now, the daughter of El was the goddess Astarte. And from the Book of Kings, we learn that King Solomon built a temple to the goddess Astarte. Thus, Solomon the Wise balanced the masculine and feminine archetypes. Astarte was the goddess of love and fertility, the very necessary female component in an otherwise unbalanced religious equation. Her traditional consort was Prince Baal the Ear King, and he was the sacrificed god, the most ancient tradition, and the original horned god of the earliest Neolithic hunting and agricultural cults. His yearly death and rebirth was one of the earliest of the many resurrection myths. Now, for the Roman Catholics, the Virgin Mary has assumed the role of the divine feminine. For the Jewish people, the Shekinah is God's female manifestation. But these are both later developments that came long after the time of King Solomon. It was these two ancient archetypes, Baal and Astarte, that I first contacted in this dark mirror experiment. They subsequently inspired me to research and create a modern Hermetic rendition of their ancient religion, the religion of King Hiram of Tyre. And, if we are to believe the Bible, a religion King Solomon certainly honored, and if we meditate upon his beautifully sensual Song of Songs, the Shasharim, we may even conjecture that he might have secretly practiced it himself. Now, this has been a brief introduction to our modern system of Solomonic ceremonial magic, and if you want to pursue this subject further, we offer a complete course, a 75-minute instructive video, and a 230-page companion book, expanding, detailing, and demonstrating what we have covered in this lecture. And if you have any doubts about the effectiveness of this system, we have recently completed another remarkable documentary video showing an actual goetic operation in which the spirit Visago delivered a prophecy for the new millennium, which is already coming true. Thank you for your kind attention and good magic. Now, we have approximately 20 minutes left, and as I said at the beginning of this paper here, I said that this was a little too scientific. I looked back over it and I thought, it's too scientific, it's too dissembling. We've emphasized the psychological and the psychological aspects of this, and I felt that it was in some ways de-romanticizing this tradition, but at the time and with the audience we were presenting it to, that was probably a good idea. But now, in the time we have remaining, let's see if we can't cure that situation, correct that a little bit. The main key to this, the main thing that I want to get across in regard to that is this. Yes, The spirits of the Galatia and the angels are all, yes, they are all related to components of your psyche, all right? But they are also directly connected to components of the universal psyche. So they have, if you think of the collective unconscious, and this is just one way of thinking about it, if you think of the collective unconscious as a gigantic ocean, now think of all of us individuals as islands in this ocean. Now think of each one of these islands has a lagoon. Now that lagoon is your own personal subconscious. These are thousands and thousands and thousands of little islands in this very deep ocean, and each one of them has a little shallow lagoon. That lagoon is your personal subconscious. But out there in that ocean, that deep blue ocean, that's the collective unconscious. Now, you can go down, diving down into that lagoon. I've done a lot of scuba diving, and so, you know, even in the South Pacific, too. So this is an analogy I really relate to. See, and go down into the lagoon, and all of those beautiful coral reefs and everything, but then there's a breach in the reef. And out beyond there is deep, dark blue. And you start going down and down and down and down and down. And you go out through that breach in the reef. And you start going down to that deep blue. And there are things living in that deep blue that, you really don't want to run into them on a bad day. And there are beautiful things, too, coming in from the deep blue. And sometimes they swim into the reef, and sometimes they swim into your lagoon. Or you can go down into that lagoon, and you can get out there and communicate with them. So, remember, Hermetic philosophy says that you are the unique representative of God. You are a unique individual representative of God, and if you are aware of your own consciousness, and you're aware that you are the eyes, the ears, and the hands of God, then you really are at the center of the universe, if you fully realize this. So the whole universe is yours. Now, you have people having that. Ever since the 1920s, we've known that the universe was a lot larger than our own galaxy. But with this, well, the things the Hubble telescope has shown us, my good Lord, the universe isn't endless, but it's so vast that it's almost indescribably how vast it is. The stars, there are more stars in that universe than there are grains of sand on all the beaches and all the deserts in this earth. And yet, that whole universe, you are at the center if you realize your own consciousness and you realize that you are the eyes, you are a pair of eyes and a pair of ears and a pair of hands directly connected to God. That's the secret of the Hermetic philosophy. Which means that those subjective realities that you have, those visions of spirits and angels, even though somebody else can't photograph them, and even though somebody else sees them differently and hears them differently than you do, they are real because they are your connection to that vast universe. And they are real. And they are real and they are powerful. Now, I thought what I would do here, in order to get a capsulized version of this marvelous philosophy across, better than just winging it as I'm doing. What I'm going to do here is I'm going to read the philosophy that Lan Duquette, playing Hermes Trismegistus, delivered from the top of Mount Shasta in our movie Beyond Lemuria, and I don't think I can possibly deliver it as well as Lon did. Yeah, and of course we don't have, you're going to have to imagine, those of you who haven't seen the movie, you imagine Lon Duquette in his shining Egyptian regalia appearing above the top of Mount Shasta with the light glowing about him and an aura, and he presents this encapsulation of Hermetic philosophy to the seekers up there at the top of the mountain. So I'll read this to you, and I think that this will get across. We'll re-romanticize our talk that we just gave. So imagine, as I say, I want you to understand that this is I wrote the script for this, and this is my script. But Lon didn't have any problems with it. He agreed with it. So you can imagine Lon up there, realizing, of course, that this is it's our script. But still, if you want a picture in there, and I'm trying to encourage you to go to Amazon and buy the movie. I think you'll really enjoy it. Anyway, we'll start off with this. You seek to understand why such mountains as this are sacred and holy. And as the master Hermes Trismegistus, I taught you that man is a microcosm of the greater universe. As a student of our hermetic master Philos, you learned that you have all the planets of your solar system living within you, but you are closest to Mother Earth. She is the greatest planetary presence within your spiritual body. So, when you climb a sacred mountain in a spiritual state of mind, you are ascending to the heights of your own planetary sphere. You become one with the Earth as she reaches to the heavens. In Kabbalistic terms, you are aspiring to Kether of Malkuth. If you wonder why we have myths and legends of mysterious temples that appear on sacred mountains, and strange creatures that inhabit the caverns beneath them, you might ask yourself, how far does this microcosmic universe within yourself extend? How many previous lifetimes have you lived on this planet? How many other lives in other dimensions are you living right now? We see an endless march of worlds going on and on beyond our conception, and yet it is only one dimension that we perceive. This, there is an invisible infinity of parallel and adjacent universes just outside of our limited perception, in which our counterparts, our shadows and reflections, live and die behind curtains that most men never part except in dreams. And this whole vast, interconnected multiverse belongs to each one of us alone. We are the masters of our own personal cosmic infinity, where life imitates art, and art imitates life, and everything in creation is a metaphor. You carry heaven and hell in your own pocket. As above, so below. As within, so without. In our philosophy, these other dimensions are considered to be levels of reality. There are many sublevels and superlevels, but three essential realities include them all: your personal reality, your shared reality, and the ultimate reality. To resolve these three realities into one, you must find that still, silent center point within yourself where the veiled light we call God resides. You will find God nowhere else. Uncover that light and let it shine forth from within you, for that light is the ultimate reality. It transforms your personal reality and it illuminates your shared reality. The one who is illuminated, all others are reflections and aspects of himself. This is the one source of his compassion and the true measure of his morality. However, I must leave you with a warning. Wisdom and immortality are the treasures of enlightenment, but no one else can give you that which is yours to find within yourself. No one else can make the decisions for you. Good and evil are for you alone to define. In darkness you may find the light, or beyond the light you may discover darkness. For in truth, you can't have one without the other. The choice must always be yours. With that philosophy, we can realize our dreams and make them real. With that philosophy, we no longer need to be concerned with producing miracles, because we realize that the universe itself is a miracle, that magic is all around us. We are magic. Life is magic. We are in a magical aura and a universe that we, if we could only realize it, as Paul Clark said when he was doing presenting mystical Christianity in the same film, Beyond Lemuria, he said, as Jesus from the top, he said, you are the master and I am a servant if you only knew it. And this is the great secret behind Hermetic philosophy and magic. You are at the center of the universe. You are at the center of the universe. I had a student who said, well, you know, I live in the center of the universe, love God, but why does everything go wrong, and why am I out of a job, and why am I all into my, all these terrible things happening to me? Well, all right. And I replied, think of yourself as a long tentacle from the great central God, and a long tentacle, and at the end of that tentacle is a pair of eyes, a pair of ears, and a pair of hands, the end of this tentacle. And you're down in a cesspool. You're down in a cesspool. And yet, you're directly connected to God. There's no other eyes and ears of God that are any better than yours, I mean, or whatever. Oh, sure, there are greater beings that have eyes and ears in other places and all that are probably greater than you are, but yet you're directly connected to the center of God. Directly connected. You are the center of God. Here you are down this cesspool. So you get all upset about it. And you say, God, why am I down here in this cesspool? Come on now, what's going on? And God says, well, all right, you're down in the cesspool. I got to have eyes down there. You know, somebody's got to be down there. I got to have something. I don't know what's going on down there. I don't like it. God, I don't like it. Everything goes wrong. Well, God says, all right, well, clean it up. Maybe I'll get a better job for you next time. Now, you know, I know that's a little cavalier, and it does make you feel much better if you're out of a job and you're wondering how to pay your bills. But then, on the other hand, just remember, you, no matter how bad things are, you have this precious consciousness. This precious consciousness is yours alone. Nobody else has it. You've got it. Everybody, all the rest of us, we're all reflections of you, because you're seeing us and you're hearing us and you're feeling us. No matter how bad things are, you're at the center of the universe. So, what do you got? You got immortality, because God's consciousness goes on. You can't die. You can be miserable, but you can't die. So you got it. So this, you know, I know that this won't solve your problems, but doggone it, it is a gift. And so try to realize it. Study Hermetic philosophy and realize this great treasure. Because magic, as well, Lon Duquette said also, he said, the only thing you can change with magic is yourself. But, you know, if you change yourself, then, because all the rest of us around you are just reflections of yourself, you'll change just about everything. When you change yourself, you change the rest of the world around you, and everything's a metaphor. So, I'm not saying that we solve all the problems, but by gosh, we can at least lead you toward what we call enlightenment. And that's what I'd like to do with magic. And I think the more you grasp these concepts, then magic will really lead you in the direction of what the Christians call salvation. If you study there, once you get this and you grok this, and once you really realize it, you could read the Christian Gospels and you can see what was really behind what Jesus was saying. You'll realize it. And I'm not a Christian, but in some ways I think I understand, from my perspective, I understand what he was saying better than a lot of them do. Anyway, we're just about out of time, and got about 5 minutes left. My engineer is telling me we got 5 minutes left here. And in that time, let's see how far we can get in let's see here. We can get in some of the teachings of some of the Hermetic teachings of Jesus here that Paul Clark delivered, because Paul Clark did a great job playing Jesus. And Jesus played off against Reverend Bobby John Rich, the fundamentalist preacher that received his enlightenment up there. And the spiritual light from the mountain illuminates Reverend Rich's face. Bobby John is seeing the same Jesus who was pictured in the painting we saw in his office. And Reverend Rich says, "Are you really the Lord?" And Jesus says, "The Master has a halo of light around him," and he answers in a soft, comforting and powerful voice, "I am. And wherever you are, there am I also. For is it not written that you shall do even greater miracles than those I performed? And is it not likewise given that you yourself are gods?" Reverend Rich is awed. Hesitantly, he asks, "Can you grant me salvation?" Jesus replies, "A better question would be, can you grant yourself salvation? For when you see the light shining in your own breast and you help others find that same light within themselves, then you become one with the eternal light that shines within us all." "What do you mean? By witnessing, I can hasten the second coming and I can be born again and help bring on the apocalypse?" And Jesus answers, "Is it not written that no man may know the hour of my return? I say to you that the second coming and being born again are one and the same, and they are within you alone. For is it not also given that the kingdom of God is within you? And thus the day of judgment comes to each of us in his own time. I am within you alone. I am within all men and all women in equal measure, but in each I am alone. I am the servant, and you are the Lord."